Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Gentlemen, this is Richard Martin here, Richard Martin's wake-up call. Citigroup has just announced 6,500 job cuts. 45,000 government layoffs have been announced this year, and that comes from the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. There's a new unfortunate corollary of this recession, depression, whatever you want to call it, namely shoplifting has been rising recently rather dramatically, and of course the experts are pointing to the prime cause, which is the sputtering economy. Since we all know that wages aren't keeping up with inflation, especially the price of food and energy, retail and law enforcement experts agree that they've seen an increase in store theft during the current slowdown, and not only from customers. And I quote Richard Hollinger, professor of criminology at the University of Florida, who compiles the annual National Retail Security Survey. He says, quote, it's clear that both employee theft and shoplifting are up. The most recent rise is being driven by the economy. A lot of people are on the financial edge. End of quote. When 116 retailers were recently surveyed about shoplifting, 74% said they believed that shoplifting incidents last year had risen from 2006, and that's according to the National Retail Federation. Well, retail theft is estimated to cost about $40.5 billion a year, and of course this cost is passed on to the rest of us in the form of higher prices. Hollinger says, and I quote, retailers can't afford to just eat that loss. Their margins aren't large enough. Let's look at a little bit of the demographics here to see what's going on behind the scenes. The shoplifter of the past was mostly trying to fuel a drug habit. But obviously that's changing now as the economy has declined. Nowadays, thieves are stealing everyday items such as groceries. And the situation sort of is exacerbated because stores have to try to trim costs since they themselves are squeezed by the tightening economy. So by reducing the number of sale clerks on the floor, it's much easier for shoplifters to grab and stash merchandise. So, employee theft is causing up to 47% of corporate losses, according to the most recent National Retail Survey. That was Hollinger's statistic. The economic slowdown has led many shoppers to seek deeply discounted products through the Internet. Criminal teams are now zeroing in on retail products and just selling them cheaply over the Internet, according to the Retail Industry Leaders Association. The Internet has made it much easier for thieves to sell more stolen items because they used to have to sell at a garage sale or flea market or through a fence, and those were generally local. Now, of course, it's easy to use the Internet to unload products across the country and the world. Many people are willing to grab those deals even if they suspect they might be buying stolen goods. And Hollinger once again says, and I quote, it's the largest, the single largest category of property crime in America, bar none. Bank robberies, car theft, nothing comes close to this. Well, what can one say? You know, as every week goes by, some new element comes into play to just put yet more pressure on an already very fragile economy. A new twist to the homeowner situation. There's a story from the Sun Sentinel, which is our local Fort Lauderdale newspaper, and they talk about a certain Steve Lee, who moved from Pompano Beach to Los Angeles, but hasn't been able to sell his three-bedroom condo, which he put on the market in April 2006, despite cutting the price from $224,900 to $99,000. Part of the problem, he said, is the home was damaged after a water leak and sewer backup. The repairs are done, but he's still tied up in lawsuits with his condo association. He's begging the bank to foreclose so he can cut his losses. I don't want a penny. Just take it, Lee said. It's absolutely destroyed me, mentally, physically, and emotionally. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. I had forecast an 80 to 90% decline in homeowner prices. And here you have a $224,900 condo now worth less than zero. The bank refuses to foreclose. No one wants it at any price. Is that what it's going to take to get rid of condos? You have to pay someone to take it off your hands? You know, people are living in their houses, they've stopped making mortgage payments, but are making property tax payments and utility bill payments. Ownership is not in dispute and the people are not fighting foreclosure. They simply choose to make no mortgage payments and the banks choose to ignore it, except for sending delinquency notices. You know, banks don't want those foreclosures on the books right now because they'll have to report them. Better a delinquency than an REO. Banks are so backed up with foreclosures and REOs, and they're so understaffed in processing foreclosures and selling REOs that they don't want to take on any more. Well, here's one reason a bank might prefer an indefinite delinquency versus foreclosure. A house with a person living in it will not be squatted upon, stripped of appliances, inhabited by crack or meth addicts, or suffer from mold damage. It will be taken care of. You know, welcome to the housing market of the 1930s. And it actually did get so bad that at one point, banks paid delinquent homeowners to stay in their homes and to look after them and to prevent just those things happening. Well, apparently we haven't got quite there yet, but we are one step away from it. You know, on this question of the crisis, I think it's useful to invoke the hurricane analogy. I'm sure you are aware that a hurricane comes in three stages. First of all, you get the front end of the hurricane, which slams through a neighborhood, and then comes the calm period, the eye of the hurricane, where everything is utterly and totally calm, as though there was nothing at all happening. Although the hurricane is raging all around. And then, after the calm, comes the second force of the hurricane, which is usually even worse than the first because it changes direction and goes the other way. I would use that hurricane analogy to describe the new crisis, which is threatening even healthy banks. According to data from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, late payments on home equity loans are at a record high. The delinquency rates on loans for cars, small businesses, and construction are spiking to levels not seen in one decade or more. Unlike last year, when soaring mortgage defaults sparked a crisis of confidence in the financial system, the root of these problems is the downturn in the broader economy. Simply put, consumers and businesses are strapped for cash with job losses growing and retail sales falling. You know, we have this problem of consumer debt and the increased delinquencies, but the institutions most at risk in this new phase of the credit crisis are regional and local banks. They stayed away from subprime mortgages. but they are the key drivers of economic activity in communities across the country. According to SNL Financial, from October to March, $6.7 billion in home equity loans became delinquent, increasing the total by 45%. Late payments and defaults in every major category of consumer debt rose in the first quarter, according to the American Bankers Association. Auto loans issued through car dealers have a delinquency rate of 3.13%, the highest since at least 1990. You know, commercial real estate is another element at the backside of this hurricane. Unemployment, by the way, is a lagging indicator, so don't depend on the unemployment figures to give you the lowdown on this. This unemployment, the low apparent rate of unemployment has been used to suggest that the worst is behind us. The idea that the worst is over is absolute nonsense. The worst cannot be behind until after the hurricanes have landed. The worst is yet to come, ladies and gentlemen. Subprime is among the smallest of the storms that will hit. Even still, subprime has dramatically weakened the infrastructure. The economic knockout blow will come from the backside of one of the impending storms. And we're talking more about that as time goes by and as we see more and more statistics rear their ugly heads on elements such as what I mentioned to you about the shoplifting situation. Okay, let me give you my information. Richard Martin, the name, Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, the program. We come to you courtesy of the Progressive Radio Network, whose toll-free number for your calls is 888-873-4643. Please feel free to call any time with your questions and your concerns. Again, the number is toll-free 888-873-4643. You can also send emails, which many people do, with questions and comments, which I will read out over the air here. And the email address to do that is rmartin@gscorporation.com. I will repeat that. GS stands for Global Strategic. That's the company where I work, Global Strategic Investments in Miami. The word corporation, please, to be written out in full. Again, the email address, rmartin@gscorporation.com. And finally, my local and direct phone number, if you want to call me in private to discuss your issues, it is 305-357-5575. Once again, the number to call me directly, 305-357-5575. Okay, Ryan, our engineer, tells me he is back and ready to receive your calls. All right. Let me just pass an observation or a comment on the impending nonsense that Congress is about to deliver in the form of what looks to me to be like very serious tariffs which are being slapped or about to be slapped onto Chinese goods. Let me say right away that tariffs are not the answer. It's absurd to imagine that a country on whom tariffs are slapped is just going to sit back idly and let it happen. Any time tariffs are placed on a country, ladies and gentlemen, you can be sure that they will retaliate. Quite apart from the fact that tariffs lead inexorably to immediate higher prices, which basically is what Congress is saying to the people of the United States by voting on these tariffs. You know, we already have tariffs on agricultural products, ethanol, and scores of other items. Already we have bills that restrict the importation of drugs from Canada and Mexico. those tariffs themselves increase the price consumers have to pay. In a global economy, those kind of policies simply cannot work. Whether you like it or not, global wage arbitrage is here to stay. Tariffs are not the answer. Incredibly, though, however, the U.S. Trade Commission has come to the opposite conclusion. Now we're looking at duties on Chinese pipe imports. And I'm just going to read out the verbiage that accompanies this, and I quote, "The U.S. International Trade Commission ruled that domestic steel pipe makers are being harmed by competition from China, a decision that will lead to tariffs of more than 100% on imports of that product. The decision, in a 5-0 vote, marks the first time the U.S. will impose duties to compensate for tax breaks and other government subsidies to Chinese competitors. The finding by the independent trade body means that tariffs on the imports of the pipe used in plumbing and fencing, set in a decision last month by the Commerce Department, will take effect. This marks a fundamental shift in U.S.-China trade relations," said Gilbert Kaplan, a lawyer for U.S. pipe makers. "It's the first time we've confronted their subsidies by putting duties on imports. Two types of tariffs will apply to the Chinese pipe. Countervailing duties used to counter subsidies will average 37.2% and anti-dumping duties to compensate for goods sold overseas at prices below those sold at home will be 69.2% on 31 of the largest producers. Other companies face higher duties." You know, this is as stupid as it was predictable. Let's, first of all, before we continue with this, let's take Harriet from Delaware. Sorry about that. There was a glitch. I have no idea what it was, but we're back. Harriet from Delaware, are you there? Hello, Harriet. Harriet, are you there? Well, Harriet, sorry about that. Will you please call back? We are back online. I don't know what happened, but I want to take your call, so please call back. In the meantime, let's just talk a little bit more about this tariff situation. This act is, frankly, as stupid as it was predictable. The bill effectively says, prices are not high enough, let's raise them. It will not save a single job. It will crush imports of these products, and that means fewer jobs and transportation jobs and dock jobs. It will cause prices to rise for those that need pipes or fencing. You know, steelmakers may misguidedly cheer this bill, but fence installers certainly won't. Consumers and businesses are being squeezed. No one anywhere can afford higher prices. For every steelmaking job we save, which is, by the way, probably not any, we will lose 10 times as many fence installing and dock unloading jobs. The question, of course, right now is whether or not China retaliates. If the U.S. demands higher prices, China could simply voluntarily tax all goods to the U.S. with an export tax and make a statement, you want higher prices here? You can have them. At least that way, China keeps the money instead of the U.S. collecting a tariff. If the U.S. is dumb enough to demand higher prices, China could easily oblige. Is there anyone who doesn't see how insane this is? There will be scores of union workers spouting nonsense about fair trade, not free trade, etc., etc., who will not understand the logic, even when it's spelled out for them letter by letter. You know, the U.S. is actually calling the pot, calling the kettle black. We accuse China of subsidizing steel, but America's insane war on terror, which is, by the way, in a war it's impossible to win, is a subsidy to Boeing, General Electric, and scores of other companies that win no-bid government contracts. Furthermore, the Americans' purposeful debasement of the U.S. dollar is not helping anyone other than those long commodities. Well, I don't know how Paulson can live with himself. Day in, day out, Paulson blatantly lies about a strong dollar policy while never once mentioning the two biggest factors in strength of currencies, interest rate differentials and budget deficits. Well, let me just tell you what happened in the 1930s. There was a Smoot-Hawley tariff that came into effect during the Depression. And here's a quick primer on what happened here. By the way, Harriet from Delaware, please call back. We are still waiting for your call, so please feel free to call. Anyway, so the Great Depression, the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act. Under the direction of Senator Reed Smoot of Utah, the Republican Party drafted the Fortney-McCumber Tariff Act in 1921 with an eye to increasing domestic firms' market share. Weakening labor markets in 1927 and 1928 prompted Smoot to propose yet another round of tariff hikes. And by the way, before I continue, let me just tell you that those tariff hikes, if you think that the crash of 29 caused the Great Depression, ask yourself why they thought they needed tariffs back as early as 1921. This is, to me, a carbon copy of what we've been seeing, an economy on the decline and people, you know, suddenly talking about a recession in the middle of 2008. It's nonsense, and hopefully in history it will be seen as nonsense, but for the time being we have to live, you know, with this kind of Pollyanna-ish world of make-believe, that everything has been okay right up until somebody declared a recession, which they haven't even yet declared, by the way. Anyway, to continue. 1,028 economists in the United States, organized by Paul Douglas, Irving Fisher, James T.F.G. Wood, Frank Graham, Ernest Patterson, Henry Seeger, Frank Taussig, and Claire Wilcox, signed a petition asking President Hoover to veto the legislation. That was the 5th of May, 1930. Automobile executive Harry Ford spent an evening at the White House trying to convince Hoover to veto the bill, calling it an economic stupidity. Retaliation began long before the bill was enacted into law in June 1930. As it passed the House of Representatives in May 1929, boycotts broke out and foreign governments moved to raise rates against United States products. In May 1930, Canada preemptively imposed new tariffs on 16 products that altogether accounted for around 30% of U.S. exports to Canada. Imports plunged two-thirds from $4.4 billion in 1929 to $1.5 billion in 1933, and exports fell from $5.4 billion to $2.1 billion, in both cases far more than the 50% fall in gross domestic product. Unemployment was at 7.8% in 1930 when the Smoot-Hawley tariff was passed, but it jumped to 16.3% in 1931, 24.9% in 1932, and 25.1% in 1933. Look, nobody is saying that Smoot-Hawley caused the Great Depression. It didn't, but it made it much worse. And the United States is now about to repeat the same mistakes. You know, manufacturing and service sector wages in the U.S. will come down. They have to come down. Tariffs cannot prevent wages from coming down without dramatically rising unemployment elsewhere. We need lower wages, lower prices, and a dollar that goes further. In other words, we need more walnuts, less or fewer tariffs, and a balanced budget out of Congress. Instead, Walmart is scaling back store plans, the U.S. is initiating trade wars, and the U.S. budget is a wreck. All right. Okay, let's deal with the mail once more. My phone number, the toll-free number here is 888-873-4643. Again, the toll-free number, 888-873-4643. All right, some mail, quite a few little pieces here on emailed information. Andy Celsius emailed me last Thursday, and he says, for your information, our company had an ESOP plan, and the value per share on the last statement was over $200, and the buyout will pay less than $15 a share. There are some who have been with the company a long time who didn't contribute to their 401k because they saw all that money in their ESOP. Suddenly, it's gone. Poof. Luckily, I'm not one of those. I've heard the wake-up call and have a decent lifeboat in place. Thank you for the warnings. On pins and needles, Andrew. Speaks for itself. Then Steve Kruger writes in yesterday and says, Richard, reading the RBS report by Bob Janjua was like an instant replay of the last 2 years of wake-up call. You have to be thinking, well, better late than never. Richard, your thinking is way ahead of the curve, and for this I am thankful. Myself, By following your advice, I feel I have avoided financial disaster, and in the near future, I will not be trading my new car in for a Walmart shopping cart. Again, thank you, Steve Kruger. The RBS report is the Royal Bank of Scotland report, in which they pretty much predict a depression. Pius from New Jersey, standing by. Hi, Pius. Pius,
hello,
is that right?
Yes, thank you. Just real quickly, I live in New Jersey, and I've noticed that there doesn't seem to be the same downward trend, at least not as severe around here, New York, New Jersey market in real estate, as in other parts of the country. What do you think that is? And if somebody around here is looking to buy a house, do you advise to wait or do that around now?
I'm not familiar with the different states' specific situations in real estate. I mean, I do know that New Jersey is suffering a downturn in direction, if not in degree. My feeling, as I've said before, Pius, on this show many times, is that you should be looking at 3 to 4 years before even thinking about buying a new house. And if you want to have some kind of a marker as to where it would be prudent even to consider buying a house, look at the national inventories of unsold property, which are now at a 10.2-month supply. That has to come down to about a 6-month supply before you can even imagine that prices will stop going down. And lots of other things need to fall into place too, by the way, but that's probably a rule of thumb guide as to where you can, you know, consider asking the question again. Areas which have not seen a substantial decline sure will see a decline, and as often as not a worse decline than other areas, simply because it means that people have the means to hold out for longer, and therefore the pressure of sales when it comes will be that much greater. But I hope that's answered your question. Again, I think that each individual community has to be intelligent about how it deals with the decline, but not so much in extent. I think the extent of the decline will be fairly uniform, and so I would wait at least 3 to 4 years before buying a house.
May I ask one more quick question, if you don't mind?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Do you see a leveling off of interest rates, or do you see it going up anytime soon?
I think that interest rates will rise quite dramatically over the very short term. Then after that, I think you will find that interest rates fall on a long-term basis as demand for money simply dries up and the upward pressure of commodities and other assets which fall in line with the increased need to cover debts comes into play. And I think interest rates will then fall over many years, and the purchase of bonds will be a very good buy somewhere down the line. Currently, however, though, I think you should stay away from the purchase of bonds. I think interest rates will move up, longer-term rates, that is, 10 to 30-year rates, over the short term.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Pius. George in Long Island. Hi.
How are you, sir?
I'm fine, thank you.
My question to you is, how would you go about bringing jobs, or manufacturing jobs specifically, back to the United States? That's where our basic economy comes from, the tax basis from the salaries and the production.
Well, bringing manufacturing back to the United States almost like requires sort of winding back the movie of the last 30 years, you know, to the signature of Richard Nixon on the paper which broke the gold standard, because, you know, unfortunately, when the Fed became able to print money like it was going out of fashion and promptly did so, what it actually was doing, the effect of this, was to price the United States out of the production manufacturing market. So that whereas at the beginning of the 70s, the United States was eminently, you know, competitive, by the end of that decade, the United States was like a beached whale. I mean, its manufacturing was far more expensive than the rest of the world could even, you know, stomach, let alone would not be able to compete with internally. And you had countries at that point, such as India and China Korea, silently and stealthily building these commercial trade schools, putting people through them, which are now, by the way, just as efficient and as capable as American trade schools, churning out, you know, scores of engineers and technicians of one sort or another. And now, of course, they are producing the same products as the United States at a tenth of the price. So, George, my guess is as good as yours. I am not sure that it can be done. Yes, of course it can be done if Americans are prepared to take a massive cut in living standards. I'm not sure that they're prepared to do that. I feel, however, that they will be obliged to do that for the sheer sake of survival, and it will not be a pretty sight. But other than that, there's no quick fix. There's no way in which, you know, these tariffs that I mentioned just now, which are, you know, the retards answer to the problem, you know, charge more for imported goods and voila, you've got your manufacturing sector back. It doesn't work like that. Never did, never will. It just makes the situation worse. So even if I had the answer, George, I don't think anybody would listen to it. So I can't, I'm not going to be much joy there for you, I'm afraid. Thank you for your question. Runa comes in with a statement about an article I sent out, which was printed from the New York Times by Paul Krugman, called Home Not So Sweet Home. Really calling into question the viability of home ownership as an automatic answer to people's problems. I don't think home ownership is necessarily the answer. And Rona states, she says, Richard, thanks for your article. Well, Krugman and I have the same opinion. Real estate has not been my choice for the last 4 years, as my calculations to real estate ownership had red flags, meaning to use great care before considering. A home is just what it should be, a home, and not a speculation. On the other hand, a functioning business is there for producing revenues. People and the newspaper journalists are talking about it now that it's obvious, but we investors have to understand before, while everyone is showing optimism. Now I'm looking through their pessimism and hope to find great opportunities. Although I realize the long side may take some time and the shorts are now in gear, but that is what makes the markets. Have a great day, Rona. Okay, thank you very much. I got an email from E for One. Subject was speculation, and he observes, he says, Kovner is what's known as a macro trader. He's referring to Bruce Kovner, who is one of the finest traders that ever lived. He's a secretive operator. He doesn't give interviews, and, of course, therefore, he's not very well known. But E4One is making the comment about this particular person. Kovner is what's known as a macro trader. He focuses on commodities and currency and uses fundamental analysis as well as charts and technical analysis. He loves following global economies, New Zealand monetary policy, for instance. He said, and I quote, I have no bias towards any of the markets. I am just a happy a trader in a bear market as happy as in a bear. Sorry, let me start again. I am just as happy a trader in a bear market as in a bull market, rates up or down, commodities up or down. Well, there's a speculator for you, a typical, very successful speculator, simply stating that he's not there to push prices up or down. He's there to follow the price trends and to make money out of doing same. Couldn't have expressed it better. Thank you, E4One. Okay. Steve Canero came in with an email, and I think he was referring to my contention that you need proof when you are dealing with conspiracy theories, because otherwise, you know, basically the credibility is in grave doubt. That was my contention and remains so. And Steve Canero says the following. He says, it's also hard to disprove some theories, too. I got the feeling Salenti was suggesting conspiracies. There was no need to ask him for proof. Intuitively, it resounds at being true. For example, we all know Oswald didn't work alone. Did Ruby kill him out of his love for Kennedy? What happened to the car Kennedy was driving in? I don't have proof or the answers, but disproving others were involved is just as tricky. By the way, all roads lead to economics, even politics. Well, Steve, all I can say to that is you're absolutely correct, but then just be aware and accept that the theories that have neither been proven nor disproven remain just that, theories. And that's what we're talking about. And my brief is with people who want to turn theories into quasi-facts as if they had been proven or as if there was some kind of proof outstanding when there is none. And I think it's very important to maintain the difference between what is a theory and proven facts. We have Trish, who wrote to me on Saturday, who had sent me a clip from a documentary called The American Ruling Class, and unfortunately, Trisha hadn't had a chance to listen to it or watch it yet, but she says, you know, Richard, I'm educated, I study hard, and still people do not believe what I tell them. I can show them articles in the newspapers, video news clips, everything, and they still live in denial. What's up with that? Trish. She wrote me another email, and I will read that to you too. She says, couple of questions, we'll try to make it short. How on earth did we get to this point? As you know, I used to email all the time, then I started school for accounting. Richard, they literally pound ethics into our heads. They teach us that what we literally hold the economy of our communities, and in some cases our country, in our hands. We had to do massive studies on this, which was such a pain to do, but they wanted to make sure we understand how critical it is for us to be honest and ethical with the books. So, are we the only ones learning ethics? Are they just now teaching it? How did these investment banks ever think of any of this mess they got us into would work? Even I as a student can see right through their fraud. It is nothing more than a massive Ponzi scheme on a global scale. What happened? If your audience truly understood, like I do, what these people actually did, I think they would be hiding under the bed. This is not going to be pretty at all when it totally implodes. I wish you could hear and see the frustration in my voice and the look on my face when I speak about this to my friends and family. Sometimes I'm just speechless. If you want to buy a stock and put it in Maalox, I'd drink enough for all of us. Just kidding, don't buy that. I have another issue I want to discuss with you, but we'll put it in another email soon. Also, tell Vicky to watch the documentary The American Ruling Class. That's the Vicky Marburger, I believe, who came in with her conspiracy question, and we discussed that at some length. I've looked into all these conspiracy theories too, and I don't buy them. There are too many variables that happen for a handful of people to manipulate everything. I recommend that documentary to everyone. You could probably find it online if you look around. It's about the investment banks and how they operate and what they think of the common people. It really is good. Okay? Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to watch this, I suggest you Google the following words. The American Ruling Class. Okay? The American Ruling Class. Okay? I'm sure that it will come up at that point. Thanks for all you do, Trish. Yes, Trish, just one comment I would make about the conspiracy people. I think the conspiracy people are being much too kind. You know, I think they hone in on conspiracies as being, you know, the black sheep of our society and the economy, when I think everybody is in on the act to some degree. And I think emphasizing and focusing on conspiracy simply avoids the issue. It sort of conveniently places the onus on the shoulders of just a few people in order, frankly, to exonerate the rest of us. And I don't think that anybody really is out of the loop on this one, although some are far more guilty than others. And when it comes to, like, housing, I think, you know, all of these people who've taken these loans are in on the game, too, and I don't think that they are absolved from all the blame. All right. Just in, I got a few minutes ago, actually, from Rene Martin, who says, hi, Richard, if you have the time, you may want to listen in. Again, thanks for all you do. And the subject is John Perkins, who wrote Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and a new book, I think, called The Secret History of the American Empire. You may remember I'd mentioned this before, the Confessions of an Economic Hitman was Perkins's description of his function, which was to convince the political and financial leadership of underdeveloped countries to accept enormous development loans from institutions like the World Bank, saddled with huge debts they couldn't pay. These countries were forced to acquiesce to political pressure from the United States on a variety of issues. And he describes the role of an economic hitman as follows. He says, economic hitmen are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools included fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I've seen Perkins myself, actually, on the on television in a book report, and it was very, very fascinating to hear him describe this book that he wrote about just this, called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. He will be on www.bbsradio.com. That's B for boy, boy, S for sugar, bbsradio.com, on Wednesday, June the 25th, that's in 2 days, at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. Eastern, talking about, I think, talking about his books, new book, the newest book, The Secret History of the American Empire, zeroes in on hotspots around the world and drawing on interviews with other hitmen, jackals, reporters, politicians, and activists, examines the new geopolitical crisis and what we can do to change things for the next generations. Okay? Sounds interesting if you have the time. Again, let me give you the website here, the special live broadcast website, www.bbsradio.com. That's John Perkins on Wednesday, June the 25th, 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. Eastern. Thank you, Renee, for that heads up. All right. We have now an email just in from Steve Kruger, who says, Richard, it is said that when you don't learn things from history, you will repeat the mistakes of the past. In 1930, history was taught in our schools. Today, we don't waste time teaching our kids history. We teach social studies, as it feels much better, not much debate in social studies. We have turned out many generations of kids that have not a clue about history, let alone political history. The sad thing is that they are sitting in Congress now. Signed, Steve Kruger. Thank you very much for that, Steve. You may have heard that George Carlin just died. He died last night. He had a lot to say about the economy and a lot to say about the kind of things we talk about here. His career spanned more than 50 years. He died of heart failure on Sunday after complaining of chest pains. You know, many of us have been fans of George Carlin since the 60s. His humor was always ahead of the curve. He had a no-nonsense approach to life. Very sad that he isn't here when we need him the most. And that comes from my wife, Marlene Martin. And I have to tell you that I agree entirely with her sentiments. We always enjoyed Carlin. We always enjoyed his acerbic take on things temporal. And we will indeed miss him very greatly. That's George Carlin. All right. I wanted to just talk a little bit about some unrelated matters differing in the way they come up. For example, the recent comments of the National Association of Realtors chief economist Lawrence Yun is making his predecessor David LeRae look like a wimp when it comes to touting the strength of the housing markets. Yun met with realtors in Coral Gables, which is just outside Miami, last week, and he told them that this is nothing more than a, quote, small blip on the radar screen. He touted prices to be 20 to 30% higher in Florida in just 5 years. You know, this idiot is now being really resented by members of the National Association of Realtors who are beginning to see these people for what they are. They don't help the National Association of Realtors in the slightest. One has to wonder who they are working for, you know. These clowns are sort of perpetrating a national fraud on consumers and institutions. The NAR never raised a flag about any of the issues leading up to the crisis we're in. They're still waving their cheerleader pom-poms. Oh, by the way, did you know that USA Today recently called Yun one of the nation's top 10 analysts on a list measuring accuracy in forecasting? I mean, these guys, Yun and LeRae, should be in jail for fraud. But, you know, the USA Today ranking just reinforces how deep the problems really are. Suicides are spiking. In Palm Beach County, there have been 256 suicide calls. Of those, 44 told operators the reason for suicide was a lost job, foreclosure, bills, or being homeless. This is a 300% increase from the same period a year ago, and a 500% increase from 2 years ago. Well, I know I'm going to hear from folks telling me this is just a Florida problem. Let me tell you, keep on drinking the Kool-Aid. Well, I wonder if you've noticed an increase in garage sales in your neighborhood. Because if you haven't, you sure will. You know, look at what's being sold as well. You're going to be shocked. Everything from clothing to flat screens, boats, jet skis, and more. If you're thinking about buying a flat screen or a jet ski or ATV, why pay retail when you go next door and buy it for less than wholesale from your neighbor? Let's get serious and take gasoline sales out of the retail numbers that the street is so happy about. Back out a few other inflated numbers that don't even belong there, and you'll see that retail is really on the ropes. When I say inflated numbers, let's face it, even the retail numbers that are up, many of these are at super discounted prices. If you take it one step further, lowest margins, lower profits, lower stock prices, not to mention layoffs and less need for replacement inventory, which means less work in manufacturing and around. How about the jewelers that are buying gold and silver, selling teeth, nose rings, wedding rings, silverware? All these are on the up and up. Jewelers say business is booming. Some of them say they've never seen it this busy or this disturbing. Customers coming in with teeth, rings, knives, forks, telling them they need the money to pay their bills and put gas in the car. You know, there's a jeweler who says he needs to buy a vacation home on the beach in Florida to get away from it all. He'd been working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. You know, buying gold and silver from people that need money for groceries. So what are they going to do when there's no money left to belt that melt down? What about the couple of talking heads on CNBC praising Lehman Brothers for reducing leverage from an all-time high of 45 to 1 to the current estimate of 25 to 1? Are they kidding? Yes, they really are. They're kidding themselves and kidding the folks that believe this nonsense. A 25 to 1, a mere 4% loss in value is a wipeout. You realize what that means? A 4% loss in the assets of Lehman Brothers, and Lehman are gone. Think about Bear Stearns, which was at 40 to 1 when they died. Lehman is not the only one with this leverage. Take a look at Chorus, Wachovia, Deutsche Bank, UBS, Merrill Lynch, Washington Mutual, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America. Well, they may not all be at 25 to 1. Some are more and some are less. But even at 10 to 1, we are in serious trouble. Just look how long it took the Fed to step in with Fremont. We're not just leveraged to leverage, but the regulators are listening to rear-view analysts with financial interests in what they're analyzing. Look, I realize that it's a stretch into a dark area, but let's call it what it is. I mean, both sides of the same teams at the banks are saying the same thing. You know, this is shocking. It's beyond explanation. You know, they say everything is fine outside the U.S. Well, you know, I'm not even sure how to respond when I hear this discussed in an interview. Have these people taken a hard look at England and Ireland, who are now suffering a housing crisis even worse than the U.S.? Have they looked at Australia and Hong Kong? Maybe they should take a peek at the Palm and World Islands in Dubai. You know, you can see the same thing with condos in the Caribbean in places like Turks and Caicos. Everything is not fine outside the U.S., and for those that think the rest of the world will keep things rolling, you know, keep on thinking. You know, nobody's going to talk to Wall Street Journal Mike Corkery because he seems to be returning to Ivy Zelman for her rearview mirror look at things. Mikey's story about bank woes is typical Corkery-Zelman, a day late and 10 bucks short. The article was packed with rearview numbers and old stuff with color and different Ivy analysis, but what these two continue to miss are the facts. Banks are peddling portfolios, but there are no buyers. That's what's happening now, but that's not what we're reading about. Prices come down and a few portfolios change hands. Some of this stuff is moving to pension funds, and that's your money. You know? Schools are going broke in Florida. They're discussing four-day work weeks to save money on utilities and buses. You know, who's going to watch the kids on Fridays when they go to school for 4 days and the parents go to work? You know, you still need to pay the teachers for the hours. You still need to keep the AC running in Florida. You still have all your fixed costs. Courts and fire stations are closing. This is welcome to the depression, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sorry. I'll be back with you on Thursday. This is Richard Martin wishing you a very successful week ahead. Take care. See you then Thursday, 2 p.m. Bye-bye.